Welcome everyone. You are at How to Optimize Your Existing Regression Testing Session. My name is Jim Bowden. I'm the track coach for this session. First thing first, let's check our cell phones. Be sure that they are on vibrate or off. If you do need to take a call, please discreetly go out in the hallway. A couple other things. You guys know the drill. The evaluation form, please fill it out at the end of the session. And you should also have a blue evaluation form in there. This is for the entire Quest conference, so be sure if this is your final session today, fill it out please and leave it here. Or if you're going to go to additional sessions, please remember to fill this out as well. And as Nancy said, it is two-sided. All right? Are there any questions? How's the room temperature feel to you guys?
Good.
Okay. Great. So we'll get our session started with Arthur Hicken. And it's joining me in welcoming him with How to Optimize Your Existing Regression Testing.
All right. Thanks, everybody, and welcome. I'm glad you could all make it. It's fun to have a full room. I was worried a few minutes ago. There was two of us standing in here, so it's great to have a big group of people. My name is Arthur Hicken, as you said. I'm from Parasoft Corporation. We're a little company that's based out of Los Angeles. We're out in Monrovia. No one's ever heard of it, but the Monrovia in California, not the one in Russia. And I've been there for 20 years this year, so in this industry that makes me a dinosaur, I guess. I tell people I've been there since before the epoch, and we used to measure the epoch in 1969, right, where the milliseconds on the computer clock start. Well, I measure the epoch at the advent of Mosaic and the web, right? That's the modern era, so I've been there since before that, so I've done a lot of things in software development. We specialize in tools and process, and so I wanted to talk today about some interesting things about regression testing. Oh, cool. I don't know what that button did.
Now I'm forced to actually walk through the machine.
Try this one instead. Cool. All right, so first thing, why bother with regression testing, right? Regression testing is painful. Can everybody hear me in the back? They didn't mic me up, so I wasn't sure. I can talk loud, though. In fact, I probably more often talk too loud. So, why bother? Well, obviously, you want to make sure that your software works. You want to find bugs. But a lot of what motivates regression testing is more fear of change. What happens if I do something? What will happen to my software? Will I make it worse? And that's a very common theme that I hear from people that I deal with. Also, compliance issues. How many here have to deal with some kind of a compliance issue? So roughly half the room, maybe a little more than half the room. There's all kinds of compliance standards out there. There's medical ones. There's payment card industry ones. There's military ones. There's automotive ones, as you see listed on here. All of these things force you to do things. The core of compliance is, say you're going to do something, do it, document it, and give that documentation to some bean counter from the government so that you can get them off your back, right? Roughly. Regression testing helps you do that, but it really helps also prevent bugs and reduce product return. So it's actually a very important thing, even though it can be quite painful and quite expensive, and we want to talk about making it less. So is anybody surprised that it's difficult to maintain a regression test loop? Right? Extremely difficult. It's usually 2, 3, 4, even 10 times more expensive in time and money than people expected it to be from day one. And it starts out relatively harmless. You've got this little test suite, and it works, and everything's clean, and you just run it, and you fix one or two things. And after 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, how many here inherited legacy code that's more than 10 years old? Okay, and your regression test suites are noisy. Right. So they get complicated. Some crazy person like me comes in and sets the thing up, and then they leave the company, and someone else inherits it, and they knew the person, and so they understood how to do it mostly, and then they leave the company, and now someone can run it, but they don't really know how it works, and then they leave the company, and now you're stuck with this thing. I've seen a lot of nods, right? This is what happens. It's the build system. It's a regression test system. It gets set up, and it becomes very fragile, prone to breakage, difficult to extend, difficult to improve. And then just the noise. Just the overall, the noise the system produces. How do we find what's real and what's not real? Noise is an interesting topic I like to cover because people have different perceptions of what noise is. I use a very simple definition. Noise to me is not simply a false positive. Noise is anything that I don't need to see. I don't care what it is. If I don't need to see it and act on it, I don't want to hear about it. And that's how people end up with noisy test suites, because they think that they need to know things that they don't really need to know. So some of the other things, like I mentioned, false positives. False positive in this case, by that I mean the message is actually wrong. There's no arguing it, it's undeniably wrong. Messages I don't like are a form of noise. By that, I probably should have put it number four, but messages I don't like might mean I'm never gonna fix this, or I don't think this is really wrong, or this tool is just extra noisy. Things that I just really don't care about. Messages I don't need. Positive messages I don't need. When I'm doing regression testing, the absence of failure means success to me. Okay? As long as I know it ran. Right? Then the fact that I have, you know, we have a runtime analysis tool that we've been selling for about 20 years. So the regression test suite has about 65,000 compiler-like tests. I don't want to see 65,000 status messages, right? It's not possible to deal with it. So it's important to make sure that the test suite is producing actionable messages, and if the message isn't actionable, then you really shouldn't be putting it in front of somebody to deal with. Now, we'll talk more in a minute about the compliance side, but as a caveat to that, when you're doing compliance, you need to make sure that you're recording those other numbers somewhere, right? The FDA auditor that shows up is going to want to know how many tests passed and which particular ones, but my testers don't need to know. They need to know which ones failed so we can fix them. Messages I don't understand. This is a pretty interesting area because, again, if you've inherited a legacy monster that someone has built, it's become Frankenstein's own baby, it's going to be full of things that you don't get. And people haven't dealt with them in years and years and years. And so we want to talk a little about that as we go on, about what to do about these kinds of things. Why does noise happen? Well, maybe the test suite the thing that you're testing itself is just plain noisy. It just has a lot of output, a lot of different things to check. It might be that the test is noisy. You've created a funny test, or it has to be noisy. It might be that you're testing the wrong thing. It might be that the tool that you're using to do the test is not the best one for the choice. And again, I'm not here to promote any particular tool, so I'm not going to talk about what's the right tool and the wrong tool, other than if the tool is forcing you to go through more effort or producing more noise, you should be looking at a different tool because it's costing you a ton of money. Again, if you take that simple, hey, it only takes 2 minutes to look at this, and multiply it by 50,000 or 100,000 or a million test cases, it becomes a very unwieldy number. You might be using the wrong method. So again, you may just want to totally rethink what you're doing to test. And as an example, I had a customer that was doing routers, hardware routers, but the software on the routers, and they had a VPN function. And the QA group came to me, and they were having trouble because they were trying to screen capture a web-based VPN client to make sure that it could send mail from Outlook. And everything worked except that somehow they couldn't screen capture new message inside of Outlook. Now that sounds to me like a web client problem and not a VPN problem, right? A VPN is a very simple thing that takes your packets and encrypts them, sends them somewhere, and decrypts them. And you can look at a packet level at a VPN traffic and say, was it encrypted? Was I able to get in without encrypting? Was I able to get in without authenticating? Is the packet headed to the right machine to be decoded? That's all I really care about. If I'm testing screen captures for Outlook, what am I testing? Outlook, right? So, and if you're in the compliance area, we're going to talk more about that, because it can really kill you, testing the thing that doesn't matter. Manual labor. I have to tell you, and maybe some of you will believe this, which is really, really sad that some of you will, but there are people today using SneakerNet. Does anybody not know what SneakerNet is? SneakerNet is when I walk over here and I pick up a device and I hand it to somebody, right? It used to be that it was a floppy, now it's a flash drive, okay? But I use my sneakers to transport data from one place to the other. And there are companies, I tell you, right now, I know companies that are doing this, where they have two systems, both of which are on a network, and they can work from one system to the other, but at some point in the testing, a bunch of magic build happens, a bunch of magic packaging happens, a bunch of magic deployment happens, and at some phase, in one case, a CD gets burned, and a human walks over and grabs the CD, walks over to the other machine on the other side of the room, and plugs the CD in. This is madness, okay? It's absolute madness. Now, that's a ridiculous case scenario, but I have to tell you that everybody I've ever dealt with has a, we would never do that, but this thing we do has to get done. It has to be manual. And what I want to do is challenge you to take a hard look at those things in your process where you say, well, this part has to be manual, and see if there's some way to make it go away. Avoid anything that requires human interaction whenever possible. Again, another simple case. I want to give some sample cases because hopefully you can go back to your own tests and apply them. So I was working with a television manufacturer a few weeks ago, and they have a test, an obvious sort of a test. At the end, they do a smoke test, which is all the software gets assembled and all these pieces get put in and the television gets built, and before the chassis goes on the TV, someone's supposed to turn it on and attach it to a video feed and see if it was really a picture. Now, this is unarguably a useful test. And when I was sitting with the customer, they're like, yeah, this has to be manual labor. And I said, really? They said, yeah, because I need a human to tell me the TV works. Now, I'm not going to discount that there might not be something that a human needs to do. But in this particular case, a human is absolutely not required for such a stupid little test. And they said, well, we have to. I said, no, you don't. How do you turn the TV on? Well, there's a button. Okay, great. Well, they make things that will push buttons these days. Okay? Is there a remote for this TV? Of course there is, right? I bet you I can use my computer or my iPhone or my iPad or some other device and I can turn that television on. Oh, yeah, you could do that. I said, and if I couldn't, don't you guys over in the department that builds the remotes have a thing that taps keys? Yeah. Is it programmable? Yeah. All right, well, you got a choice, a software method or a hardware method. Don't care. We're going to turn the TV on. Now you've got to have somebody hook up a signal to the TV. Is that manual? In their case, yes. Somebody's got to plug a cable in at some point to get a signal to the TV. After that, the computer turns the TV on, feeds a known signal into the television. We're not going to just turn it on to channel 7 and see whatever static comes in, right? We've got to have a picture to make sure that we know it works. So we're going to use some kind of probably a digital video feed, right? Because of that, I can put a camera in front of the television, screen capture the picture, do a quick dip with the picture I sent to the screen, and I can not only tell you that the TV turned on, I can actually tell you when the pixels are failing, or if a big block of them is failing. Single pixel might be tough, but a big block, a funny blob, a blur in a corner, I can tell you if I wanted to spend the time and money doing that level of signal processing. So now all I need is a human to plug the cable in, and guess what? I could probably get a little bot to do that if it was a really expensive operation. Now, this customer is in Taiwan, so probably people are cheaper than bots. But there's a lot of things you can do, and that's the point. You may think it requires a human to either perform the physical task or it requires a human to perform the analysis, and those are two things that you really need to look at. So, avoid manual scanning of results, essentially what I was just saying, right? A lot of people do this kind of funny thing that we do with spell checkers, right? How many people have trained their Microsoft Word for every kind of word that you use in the documents you send to people? Yeah, I'm that crazy guy. I add things to my dictionary, and the truth is that, yes, eventually it will let me misspell some word because this funny word is something I use in my business. But I would rather do that
than sift through the 150 violations at the end of a single page document and try and figure out which one's a real spelling error. Okay, it's the same thing. If people are manually scanning results, what happens is, as the volume of results goes up, the chances that someone will find something go down. So if you give me a page of 10 results, I'll quickly find the one real one. If you give me 10,000 results, the chances I find that real one are almost zero. So if you're manually scanning results, you need to be looking at, why are we doing this manually? What can we do about it? And move from there. Automation tools. Does anybody here still use Cron? I'm sorry. We have a few hardcore guys in our office that still love Cron too, but sometimes you have to, but there are much better things these days. It's better to find a really good scheduler. And I understand, like, if you're on Windows, Cron seems great, right? Better than Windows, anything Windows has in the scheduler. But the problem with Cron is that it's not very fault-tolerant. It's not very informative, not very forgiving. So if you're using Cron, I would challenge you to go look at something like Hudson or Jenkins and take a look at what a real scheduling system can do for you. Because the real scheduling system, and this is kind of the point around this, it will let you make sure that you know what to do in case of a failure, which normally you have to program with Cron. It handles the sort of chicken egg problem that you have with source control. In other words, if I use Cron to check out some source that has a build script, and the build script is in Cron, how do I update the build script in Cron without a human intervening? Right? Shake your head no, right? We have this problem all the time, right? Because at some point I'm going to update the script that Cron is running. Well, with Hudson and Jenkins, I can make the first step a checkout, and then all the instructions are always up to date if the source control system's up to date. So one of the things I want out of a scheduling system, and again, Windows Scheduler is, as you may have guessed by now, worse than Cron. It's less reliable. Does anybody here have to deal with Windows Scheduler? See, good. Oh, one person. I'm sorry. No, it's the problem with Windows Scheduler, again, it's more unforgiving and less reliable than Cron. That's the problem. If something goes wrong, it fails. You don't know that it failed necessarily. You don't necessarily know why it failed. You may never even figure out why it failed. Right? You fall back on the, have you tried to turn it off and on again? Yeah.
Does tend to run with admin privileges, though, so you can schedule it to start a new shell in a minute, and then you've got an admin console on Windows box without having to actually go through boot screen.
Yeah, there are things you can do, but in most cases, I haven't found yet anything I couldn't do with Hudson or Jenkins that give me the same kind of capability. And I just happen to mention those as the ones that I use. They're free and useful. And
does Windows do something different in Cron versus?
Well, Windows doesn't have Cron. They have their scheduler, right? Unless you install Cygwin or something. But the idea is that when you're running, and this is what I want to talk about, the requirements, I want to have conditional logic for failure. In other words, if I have four steps in here, and I'm a Cron job, what happens when step one fails, step two fails, step three fails? Now, I can write all of that logic into my script and hope that my script itself doesn't die, or I can use more of a controller, which is essentially what your scheduler becomes, more than just a scheduler, but a controller, so that it decides, okay, if step one succeeds and step two fails, do I want to go to step three? And I can program these kinds of conditional logics in good scheduling systems. Paper trail. Is Cron leaving a good paper trail for you? And yes, I know you can redirect everything to a big old log file sitting somewhere. I've done it myself many times. And you can put a date and time stamp on it, and you can put all of these into a directory somewhere, but that's just a big pile of information. It doesn't really have actionable results. It certainly doesn't have the kind of thing that if the FDA shows up that you want to give them to get them quickly out of your hair. So that's one of the issues, is the paper trail and the quality of the paper trail. And with compliance issues, paper trail is so critical, because I have this view that when an auditor shows up, what I want to do is hand them something about that big. Maybe bigger, but usually as long as I can get my hands around it and stick it in front of the desk in front of them. And on the top, there should be the summary that they need that says, hey, tests passed whatever percentage we're supposed to pass, 97%. we're good to go, here's the summary, blah, blah, blah. And the rest is for them to play in. And then I can lock them in a room and ignore them for the rest of the month, the rest of the year. What I don't want is them to have too much data so they can find something that they didn't expect, and so little data that they go, well, you don't really do your job. Right? It's this funny game that you play with the auditors. But if you give them a good summary and you give them a quick capability to go and say, let me pull the thread on this test. Which requirement does this test belong to? Who approved this test? Who approved this requirement? When did this test get run? Did it succeed? Did it fail? When did this test get changed? Who approved the change? And they're typically going to pull the string on two or three or four of these things. And if you give them a nearly instantaneous answer, you're in good shape. If you give them a, I'll let you know tomorrow, every time they ask a question, guess what? They're going to live in your office. You will never, ever get rid of them. So paper trail becomes important. Again, you can build a system like this, but the beauty is that there are systems out there that just give it to you. Right? Connection to source control. Again, if whatever system you're using has a real tight integration with the source control system you're using, it makes this sort of chicken-egg problem of, are the scripts that I'm running also in source control? Really, they should be if they're not. How do I get them updated and keep the job running? Are they always one day behind because part of the source control happens with them? So making sure that you can check things out of source, update things to source, do full checkouts versus incremental checkouts and things like that are all important. And Delta reports. I need to know not necessarily what happened, I need to know what happened today that was different than yesterday. Again, let me ask the question differently this time. How many people here are not dealing with legacy code? All right, so for those sitting in the front and couldn't look in the back, we got one guy over here who gave a half-hearted arm, okay? And another one there with a half-hearted arm, right? So they're probably dealing with something that's relatively new, which is awesome, okay? You're creating the headache for someone 10 or 20 years from now.
Yes.
That's what you're doing. So, you know, if you're expecting that you're going to hire your son or daughter, you might want to really make a mess out of this thing and have some fun with them. Okay? I happened to work with my son. He started at Parasoft about 2 years ago. Now, when I started there and he was 5 years old, I didn't really foresee this happening. I might have created a better trap for him at that point, but it's important to have these deltas, because what happens in legacy code is that, we'll ask another question and no one will raise their hands up. How many people have a completely clean regression test suite? Awesome. How big is it?
It's about 600 to 700 tests now.
Okay, so it's a manageable size. That's great. No one else here said they had a completely clean test suite, right? So what happens is, if he gets a failure, he knows it needs to be fixed. What's your failure rate? Is it like 100% pass? Or just 100% you understand what it is?
Third place is when it's built in, you show something through and identify the system causes and fix.
Right, and you can figure out because there's a finite number. Finite number. Even if there was one person, it's finite number. It might be too long with one, but when you get to 100,000 tests, 200,000 tests, 300,000 tests, and you walk in on one of these little Frankenstein monsters, and the tests are failing at a constant 10% rate, which is not uncommon, then you've got to understand, hey, I'm not going to fix this thing. This thing hasn't been fixed in 10 years. And touching it is probably more dangerous. How do you know which one of these things to fix? So the Delta report gives you a great starting location. If your tool can't produce Delta reports and you have a legacy problem, then you should be looking at a different tool. Okay. Less is more. So, you know, we talk about the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And that nothing but the truth part is the interesting part, right? Everybody's watched like court dramas on TV or the movies, right? And people start wandering off at the mouth at some point instead of the yes or no question, and that's when they get in trouble, right? You want your test suite to tell you only exactly what you need to know that's important to deal with. And again, with compliance, this is especially important. And what I'm not saying here is lie to your auditor. What I'm saying is don't test things, don't measure things that aren't important to the auditor, because failure of a non-critical component shouldn't trigger a problem with an auditor. Or a constant failure of something that's known to work, which is probably a bad test case, shouldn't trigger a warning with an auditor. So tell what you need to tell. Make sure the test shows what you needed to show. No more, no less.
So we work with quite a few FDA companies. Does anybody here work at FDA stuff? We got a couple.
So it's funny because a lot of what some of our FDA customers do is, some of them have some web-based things. We work with one in particular that has category X pharmaceuticals. Now you wouldn't think pharmaceuticals company software, kind of weird, right?
Nano pills or something. But what happens is category X drugs, essentially, you could define them as, if you take them properly, they might kill you. So they have this rigorous screening process that involves a doctor, the patient, comparing the results with expected results, looking for problems, etc. And initially, when they started testing, they were doing screen capture, like every single screen. How many people here do something like that?
Good, nobody. That's perfect, right? If I'm testing Amazon, I don't want to check, log in, add new account, add credit card, address, add book, pay for book, change shipping, it has ship book. Because when that fails, I don't even know what to chase. I might need an end-to-end test at some point. Arguably, I do. But somewhere in my test suite, I need small, discrete things that test the thing I care about. And if all I care about is that it rejects a bad credit card, I need to capture the login screen to prove I logged in. I need to capture the credit card change. I need to capture the credit card failure. And the 47 other steps that Amazon forced me through to get there, don't care. Don't care. And again, in a compliance issue, if I've got those and I can argue that, hey, I showed every critical point in the path, auditor goes, yeah, you proved it. It worked or it didn't work. There's your proof. As opposed to if I've got all those 47 steps and one of them changes because Amazon changed their logo, do I want to re-record my test suite? The answer is if I'm FDA, it's not whether I want to. I'm doing it, right? And most compliance issues, it's the same thing. If you change a logo, it may change your testing. Now, if your test tool is dependent on your logo, you better hope that your logo is critical to your business needs. If not, you've got the wrong tool, the wrong process, and that's really the point. Failed tests should roughly indicate the problem. Again, there are end-to-end tests, but I presume that lots of regression tests are really much more micro-functional.
So again, with a VPN, I want a test that says I can connect if I give it authenticated, you know, username and password.
I want one that has a real username and a bad password. I want one that has a bad username and a real password. I want, you know, a sequence of tests that are very small, simple things. When they fail, I don't spend tons of hours going, what on earth could have gone wrong? I go, oh, look, we have an authentication problem. Oh, look, we have a credit card number processing problem. Oh, look, we have username problem. The test should not just assure that the software works, but they should assist the developer in getting somewhere. So if you have tests that you hand off to a developer, the developer goes, I don't know what went wrong here. You might want to think in your next iteration about building a test that's more helpful. Avoid tests that fail frequently. Okay, if the test is failing all the time, there's really something wrong with it.
It might be that your environment is bad. It might be that the product is bad and really has a stability issue. It might be that the testing tool is bad, but you need to look back, figure out what's going on. Don't live with the fail frequently. Figure out what's going on and make it go away.
If the tests are difficult to maintain, again, ask yourself, is this test providing more value than its cost? I think of more of a risk assessment approach where I look back and I say, hey, this test costs me so many man hours every week. If this thing occurs in the field, short of a compliance issue where maybe I have to do it, but if it occurs in the field, it will cost me this many man hours to find and fix. If that number comes out wrong, I shouldn't be running that test. And that's a very pragmatic approach, and frequently when I talk to people, they get like a little, you're saying don't run some tests. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I would rather have 100 tests that I knew were perfectly real and told me something meaningful than 1,000 tests that I ignored. Right? It's really kind of that simple to me. And again, if the test doesn't really help at the debugging side when it fails is to really rethink it. It might be that you need to put more information into it. It might be that you need to break it down into smaller pieces. And again, we talked about avoiding the long sequence of screen captures because they're really not very useful. Review process. How many people here go through a review process on the creation of the tests that they use? So it's, again, a little less than half, I'd say, or around a third. This is a very interesting practice that I think, like with the development side, is something that more and more people are going to do. The beauty of the review process is I take somewhere a requirement, in theory, early on, because your companies all give you the requirements way early, long before they're due, and you have nothing to do for 6 or 8 weeks until the code will magically show up finished, right? So at that point, in theory, what you can do is you can start looking at the requirements. See, what would I do to test this? And you write up little test plans. And then you pass them around in the group, and you go through normal review process where peers review each other or managers review members of the team, and you get a second set of eyeballs to look at it and say, hey, there's the requirement. You said I'm going to screen capture. Why are you doing that third capture? What's it going to prove? Or, you know what? You never did prove that the thing actually worked. And so having that set of eyeballs to look at it to make sure that you're doing enough and not too much can be very helpful. You can find out, does the test prove what it's supposed to do, right? Does it do anything we don't care about? And again, in compliance area, generally things like FDA are going to force you to do this level of work. So if you are doing a review, or if you haven't done it and you're starting to think about it, make sure you're doing a review in a way that you're getting an audit trail out of it, because at some point it'll be valuable to you, whether you're going for an ISO certification or whether you're going for some kind of FDA compliance or anything else like that. The other cool thing about code review, which is kind of an unexpected thing most people don't know, is that it really increases understanding, right? Because what happens is when you have 10 people working on a big test suite, and generally they have their own little area. I know how the credit card stuff works. I know how the login stuff works. I know how the back-end stuff works. When you start cross-pollinating, where they're looking at each other's tests, they start to understand other parts of the test system. And so it makes them more flexible, more agile, so that they can move from place to place. It increases their understanding, and especially, I like to set up a review so that people who are bumping review each other, not necessarily based on their titles in the organization, but based on the fact that this guy does authentication and this guy does, you know, back-end data lookups, then it's useful for them to cross-pollinate a little because they're touching each other already. So the people that naturally have some form of overlap, you can just kind of naturally expand it and give them a more useful understanding of what's going on, which A, makes it faster for them to work, B, makes it easier for them to move on to another project, and C, because they understand a bigger picture now, the chances that they build good tests and understand what goes wrong with them really goes up. So code review is one of those funny things that the benefits in stopping problems, et cetera, are probably far smaller than the benefit of increasing the understanding. Where possible, review the code and the test at the same time. This isn't possible in all organizations, but if you have a test scenario written out and you pass it back to the developers, they can kind of understand what they're writing to, which is really great. And if they go, wow, that test really didn't do, again, it gives you another set of eyeballs. So it's great to have it that way. Again, looking for too much is as bad or worse than looking for too little. Severity. So severity is something, in the static analysis side on software, people recognize that messages that come out of testing don't all have the same value. Some are important to me, and some aren't. Now, when we built our first regression test suite for our tool back in probably 93 or 94, we used to have this funny little script with the cron job, and it would run, and it would count the pass-fails, and then there was a little message in it, right? At like 90%, it would say, hey, it worked, ship it, you know? And at like 80%, it'd say, hey, you need a little more work, and at 70%, it'd say, you know, someone should get fired. Something like that, right? The problem is that initially, when it was a few hundred tests, it was easy to say that. With 60,000 tests, we have a certain level of noise that we live with. And I don't know what's important and what's not important. At this point, if I have a test that's been running for 10 years and we haven't noticed it's not an important message. It's not an important failure. To me, the important failure is really which things would stop me from shipping the product, right? And I have to ask myself, if this thing wouldn't stop me from shipping the product, why am I testing it? Would we fix it if we found it? If the answer is no, then I really ask myself, what's the point? Don't fix things you don't want to fix. But what you need to do then is set up some form of severity. If you have a problem where you have a bunch of things that you know these are no-go items, we find these, everything's halting. These are, maybe we'll inspect them. These are, we're going to inspect them someday. Right? And these are, we all know those are crap. Okay? If you get past that, you're really in trouble. Setting up these kinds of things around your messages, you can encode them in outputs, you can encode them in types, you can run processes against them and flag different kinds of messages, etc. But coming up with a severity scheme allows you to take that big pool of stuff and start to slice it into something manageable. Now, no-go, I'm going to always do, okay, by definition. We'll do it someday. I'm going to turn that off, actually. Guess what? I'm just not going to run them anymore. Don't need them. If we're going to fix it someday, we'll run it someday. Okay? And that mythical day when I have nothing to do, we'll run that test suite and we'll fix that stuff. I'm not even going to run it to it. Fix if you have time, guess what? I'm turning that one off too. Unless I have a compliance issue that requires me to run that, I ain't doing it. Because again, when I have time, I'll run it. Okay. And it sounds crazy, right? Everybody's laughing, but I can't count the number of customers I've dealt with that I'll show up and they'll say, well, we have these 5,000 issues in this single file. And we know that we should fix them someday. So we want to have that notice there in front of us. I'm like, you know what? You're never going to fix those. And I know I have one customer, they've been in that file for at least 5 years. They're not fixing these. It's pointless. It skews their testing system. They don't really know what their quality is because they have this weird spike in the system. And then they have some other issues that they're testing that they know they're kind of a, well, we know we should do this, but we don't have time for it. And again, it's really kind of pointless. So important to really set some kind of message around what you're testing because it helps you make the case that we shouldn't do this to management, but it also helps you decide what's important to do and what's not. Sharing results. Okay, so I want to qualify this that, again, somewhere you need a storage system that keeps track of all your results over time. Okay? It can be as simple as a bunch of files in a directory with date and time stamps. I don't recommend these kinds of things because they're hard to analyze. I'm a database guy. Stuff in a database, right? Testing messages always come down to there's a file, there's a test, there's a line number, there's a status message, there's the message itself. Create a little database and store the darn thing, okay? Because then you can analyze it over time. You can look at what's going on. Are we getting better? Are we getting worse? Is this something that's always failed? The second that you have results over a year or 2 years or 5 years, you can quickly tell the things that you shouldn't be running, the things that you can easily ignore. Right? Because you have that kind of data. So with all of that aside, and that's a very maximalist approach, right? Store everything. What do I actually share? What do people get? And how do they get them? Now, once upon a time, people thought it was really cool to email stuff. Right? Email was a really nifty thing. And probably there's some of you that are now offended by me saying that. But email's just so 20th century. Okay? Your email client, it's nice because your email client, everybody has it, it's on their phone, it's on their iPad, it's on whatever, they can get it anywhere, but it's not actionable. My email client's my email client, it's not where I work. I need the results somewhere where I can work on it. Sometimes there's web tools that do this. The web tool can be useful because I can do a lot more with it than I can with an email client. I have different security model around my web pages that are local than my email client. I don't want it doing really bad things to me. God forbid I should get a virus. But the web page, while it can do more and approaching what an application can do, it still isn't the place where you're normally working. So it's best if you can take the results and stuff them in whatever the work environment is. So in case of developers, we like to stuff it into, say, Eclipse or Visual Studio or something. If you're working inside of Mercury, QuickTest Pro, or whatever, we want your results to show up where you're working. Because if they show up where you're working, they're very actionable. You can go through them one by one, tick them off, do what you need to do, find the right test, find the right code, find the right results, and get them all working together. So if you're working in VI, then results should show up in VI. But get the results, resist that urge to say, well, we emailed to everybody, so we have a very, very powerful integrated system that does notification. Go back to, but no one uses email to write their tests, no one uses email to run their tests, and no one uses email to look at the results of their tests or fix their tests, right? Well, is there anybody here using email for that? You could. You actually could. But short of that, don't do it that way. Task management systems are great. Mylan is free. Everybody familiar with Mylan? Mylan's a nifty little thing. It's an open source thing. And it lets you inject tasks into a task pool. And then there's various clients that pull tasks out of task pools. And it has the concept of ownership. Eclipse has it built in if you ever play with Eclipse. But you can integrate it with tons and tons of things. For example, bug tracking systems can feed issues into Mylan. So if your test suite is feeding issues into the bug tracking system, and then bug tracking system feeds them into Mylan, then developers get stuff automatically. You don't have to go talk to them because they're annoying and they smell funny. So it's important. It helps that communication phase to make sure people get what they need, where they need it, when they need it. All right, so key items and test cases. Notice that I put number one, maintainability. If I run a test and I know this test is going to break next week, next month, next year, and for my kid 20 years from now, then it's really a bad test case. And again, I need to look at, do I need to test this thing? But presuming that I do, if this test case is something that is dependent on me knowing the right date, the right temperature outside, the weather, it's going to be really, really difficult to make this thing work right. It's going to be a very expensive test. So look at how hard is it to maintain. Proper assertions. The test should understand what it's checking, and it should understand when it passes, when it fails. And I'm as guilty as anybody else. I have a whole bunch of tests and stuff I've done where the test runs, and the lack of a crash is supposed to indicate success to me. This is a pretty crappy test, okay? Sometimes you have to do it that way, but it's a pretty crappy test and not useful long term. It really should say, I'm expecting this result, I saw this result, and I'm good to go. So I'm going to reiterate it until it's louder. Say that you have a test created, it failed, there's a bug, and the bug never gets fixed, but it's in the system. And the test is in the system. So the test is running, it's failing, bug's already filed, you've created a new piece of noise, right? I'm going to work from the presumption that the developers did the right thing, okay? Because I have to, right? I have to presume the other people are doing their job properly. Someone should review that bug and determine, hey, this doesn't matter, this does matter, etc. The bug should not sit in an unclosed state. That's a process problem. And that is the most typical thing to occur, right? It's a great question, actually. Because I see it, again, in our own software all the time, where the developer takes a cursory look at it, decides this isn't important, and moves on without any action. Now, you might be right, you might be wrong, because it took a cursory look. I'd prefer that the developer was willing to stand behind that decision by putting his name to the bug and closing it. And that's what should occur, right? If somebody comes along and says, invalid won't fix, then it would be great for you to say, okay, fine, this test case is now invalidated. That way, they never really have a problem again, right? You can either fix the test case, but you know that it's producing something that's not helpful. Development is really breaking down when you have an open bug. If they go, this isn't important, they should mark it again, and put in the note in whatever bug tracking system you're using and say, this thing, it's such a tiny issue and the risk of fixing it is so big, et cetera, and it should close the issue. And you should get the notification on the testing side that this is not going to be fixed because it's not critical, and you should adjust your test suite. In this case, I would suppress this thing. Right, depending on what mechanisms you have, I'd either set it to a set 5, we'll fix this someday when it occurs, or I might delete it from the test suite. I don't like to delete tests, so I'm more likely to turn it off or turn on some form of suppression against it. But open bugs sitting in the system are indicative of a software development problem and should be addressed. It looks like we had another question there. Right, right. Either. That's what I mean by turning it off. Skip it. Skip it or set it, depending on your system, whatever works best for you. But to continue to run it when the bug is open means there's a development problem. If the bug's closed and you're continuing to run it, they've told you it's not important. You either need to fix it to produce the right output or stop running it. Regular nightly runs. All right, so regular runs now, in some cases I understand it's not feasible to run nightly, some really big systems, but some organizations like to run tests, like they start right before the release. And the release might be twice a year, three times a year, might be every month or every week, then it's okay, but they end up with this spike that the tests are like living organisms, right? They decay, don't they? Over time, isn't it weird? They just decay, they don't work well. Everything is great today, a month from now, I'm not going to run. A month from now, a bunch of them are going to fail. Right? It's really odd, but that's how it works. So you need to run the tests as frequently as possible to keep the system clean. And again, if you're finding things that are bugging you constantly, then you know that they're not real. So regular runs can really help you to weed stuff out. Manage the delta. Again, having a clean test suite, not always possible, especially in a legacy system. I think we've talked enough about Delta. Running the test suite, again, it should be a batch mode. You should use a scheduler of some form. You should run it on a consistent frequency. And again, it's useful to do release-based testing, but if you run the test on a chronological schedule, once a day, once a week, it gives you a delta of normal comparison for how you're doing. So it's a different metric than the pass-go metric. Instead, you're saying, hey, is this week worse than we were last week? Is this better than last week? And if you're running the test irregularly or an irregular set of tests, it's very difficult to say, are we better or are we worse than yesterday? And in testing, we should always be a little better, right? If we can't tell, then we don't really know what we're doing. Only report failures, not success, again. And reports should go somewhere useful, as I mentioned a minute ago, right? Not just sitting in a file somewhere, but it, on the user side into a tool, and on the other side into some kind of an actionable historical system that would give you, hopefully, some form of analytics. We'll quickly go through this because we're running short on time, but nightly run, testers review results each morning, right? So they fix things, hopefully, and then they check them back into source control. They're analyzing what happens after the problem gets sent to the developer and killing tests that are noisy. Right? A lot of people kind of skip this step that they go, well, okay, this isn't, they took the time to analyze the result and then they went, this isn't important, I'll ignore it. That may be manageable as long as you're the person looking at the result, but at some point you won't be doing that job and you're leaving a legacy problem for someone else. So cleanup is part of your daily thing, right? Fix problems, fix assertions. If it's the code that's broken, send it to the developer. Test cases should always be in source control. Does anybody here have test cases that aren't stored in some kind of a source control repository? Awesome, okay. It used to be that was really frequent, people didn't. That's great. I recommend you separate auto-generated test cases from hand-coded ones because they have a tendency to get overwritten by auto-generation tools, right? If you're making changes to them, move them out of there so they're protected. Store the tests, there's a lot of different ways to do it, but store them so that they're somehow related to the code they're testing, so that it's obvious to somebody, again, who walks in a year later, 5 years later, that here's the code, here's the tests, they belong together. Through naming convention, through location. One interesting thing you can do is that you can associate tests with coding requirements. So putting comments in your tests and using little things like at rec or at PR or at task, or any, maybe you can make up your own tag, but putting a consistent thing that tells an ID number, like a bug tracking number, a requirement number, allows you to later take automation and build reports that associate requirements to bugs, to tests that failed, etc. So it's a very nifty little trick that you can do. You can put it in your check-in comment, you can put it in test code itself, and the beauty is that you can start to analyze the source control system, the bug tracking system, the regression testing system, and because you have this thing that becomes kind of a primary key or a foreign key, you can now associate things that happen with each other. And it allows you to create little trails through the code. So it's one of those free things. It's just a process change, but it allows you to really connect the dots. So test creation strategy.
There's no silver bullet, sorry. Anybody come for a silver bullet? I'm sorry, you're disappointed. Careful
thought produces better results. And again, this is one of those things that we frequently skip. It's just, hey, I got the requirements, let me just start creating a bunch of tests. Time put in up front to make sure that you're testing the thing that matters, that failure indicates something useful, that passing indicates something meaningful, will save you a ton of money down the road. That's really the most important thing. Other than that, you can use some automation, you can use templates, you can create everything by hand, but putting the thought in up front, actually putting time in the budget to think about the tests and design the tests and architect the tests is important. Virtualized infrastructure, how many people use virtual machines to do their testing? So again, we're probably a little more than half, I'd say. Great way to just stand stuff up, right? You can take a database and stand it up in a known state with a known set of data and either roll it back or trash it and clone it again when you start. Having these kinds of environments is really great. I've seen some customers where they had a room this size full of old PCs. Every time someone left and their PC was old, they would send someone into the office and steal it, add it to their lab. And I'm looking at the lab going, some of these things are not only dinosaurs, but I could replace this all with like two ESX boxes and it'd be far more flexible. So easy, great thing if you're not doing it today. Input exceptions, just real quick, I'll cover this and we'll get to a little more Q&A. A lot of people skip testing for input exceptions. It's really easy if you're requirements driven to not think about what happens when people put bad input into my program, but that's the easiest way to kill a program. It's easy to break a program, it's easy to crack a program. This is how most security violations end up occurring, is it's people throw funny input at your program and see what it will do. Okay, and one of those things is like in C code, you can have a block of theoretically dead code that the parser still compiled, like an if zero else, and that block still exists. And a memory overwrite, because of a long name, can force you to execute a piece of dead code, which is really, really dangerous. So if you have any kind of security issues, compliance issues, etc., you really need to check and use tools to check varieties of inputs to make sure that the thing just doesn't work right, but that it accepts the normal crap people do when they type, like a letter and a phone number, and accepts or checks for the bad things that people can do. And exception handling, same thing. People frequently skip setting up tests for causing exceptions. It's frequently hard to do. You have to have really a code level tool to do it. But this is one of those things, if you have an application that fails frequently, it fails under load, but you can't really specify the location or time. If it fails stability, it fails once every 3 weeks, the darn thing crashes, or that it has that dreaded death spiral that we're okay, but when we get one user too many, then the connection pool dies. When the connection pool dies, the database dies. When the database dies, the web server dies. When the web server dies, the user dies. So it's important to really check that exceptions are handled properly. And I think we kind of discussed it, right? The bugs build tests, right? When you find a bug in the field, a new test should go into your regression test suite. And there should be a policy in place to enforce that. Is it working? I think we kind of covered that. So Oh, I still got my old slide. I have a blue guy in here now. So, questions?